should be no ranking system for toughness.
But one time I wrestled a giraffe to the ground with my bare hands.
Welcome everyone again to the Talking Split podcast. I'm Rob Calder, joined this week by Nathan Cooper-Brown. Welcome, Coops.
Good to see you both.
Jenna O'Hay, welcome back, Jenna.
Hello.
Fantastic to have everyone along with us this week. If you can follow along on the Talking Split socials using the handle at Talking Split on X and Instagram, I did finally put the drill up that I promised we would film months ago. It is finally up there now. By the time this episode's dropped, I promise that it will be up there that you can go and have a little bit of a look at. So we are going to try and post some new stuff on there every Monday night from a drill content perspective. So if there is anything you're after, if you want like ball handling drills or shooting drills or something like that, let us know. We'll try and find some kids to film it, put it up there with teaching points, all those sorts of things. So if there is anything you're after, let us know on that and we will come back to it. Big shout out to the Victoria Country Girls that come in on a Saturday session early because they come in about an hour before they need to and have done some filming for us over the course. So thank you very much to them for jumping in for that as well. Straight into it, because we have got a lot to get through on this one.
You know you make me want to have my cold chairs, have my cold chairs, have my cold chairs. Come on now.
Big thank you to Elvis once again for jumping in. Lydia Brooks from the Ballarat Under 12 Girls and the NBL 1 Women's Development Coach, former player that is transitioning into coaching over the last number of years. She's coached at Jamboree, Country Cup, FDP, SDP, always working hard to get better as a coach and shows genuine care for the players. Great communicator and all the players love her as a coach. She was part of the Accelerator Women's Coaching Program that we ran up in Bendigo as well. And personally, I really enjoyed her takes on things. She looks at the game from a holistic perspective and not just dialed in on one area. So really enjoyed having her along with that. So good job, Lydia, in that space. Straight into book club. I know this is a little bit out of order, but you know, straight into book club for this week.
Many leather-bound books, and my apartment smells of rich mahogany.
Reader submission this week. Dylan Cole has thrown one in this week. Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. Have not read it in years.
Excellent book.
Big fan, Jenna.
Big fan.
What did you like about it?
Just makes you think about things so differently.
Yep.
I'm very black and white thinking, and this just got me, thinking about things in a very different way. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, cool. Easy. You've read it as well, Coops?
I haven't. No.
Haven't?
Oh, no.
You would love it.
Yeah. It's a very Coopsy book.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right.
Okay,
yeah, nice. You'll be on board this one.
So. Have you read any of the Gladwell books?
No.
Coops.
I know.
Get down your alley.
I know, right?
Yeah, get off the NFL stuff. Yeah. Like, no good to. Like, who cares about Pete Carroll? Like, it's no one. It is a good read.
Okay. Right,
so it talks a lot about the factors that contribute to the success of people. It's a little bit of the nature and nurture stuff that we sort of spoke about with the Adam Grant book, Hidden Potential, a couple of weeks ago, like about creating opportunities and pathways for people that experience disadvantages to be able to still progress. The whole 10,000 hours, so that came from Outliers. Mm. So you need 10,000 hours to perfect a skill. Where do you sit on that, just out of curiosity, both of you? Jenna, where are you at with it? 10,000 hours, agree or disagree?
In a certain way, I agree.
Yep.
To perfect something, you need to do it a lot.
Yep.
And I know I put
more than 10,000.
Yeah, for sure. Yep. For sure. But I think you can still be good at things.
Yeah.
I think there's the natural talent of some people, but no, definitely you need to put the work in.
Yep. Coops, where are you at?
Yeah, I think it's about the habit, right? It's the habit of committing to something and the repetition, but I think a specific number is
get a little dangerous. You don't just tip over the edge and you get this new badge for shooting unlocked.
Yeah.
Like it doesn't quite work that way. But it is interesting. Like I know the skill acquisition people are like, no, doesn't make sense. And it's like, yeah, I don't know that you can categorically say, no, it doesn't make sense. It's, you know, there is some repetition in there. And it's the whole, you know, is it 10,000 hours of practice or is it 10,000 hours of perfect practice? Well, okay, there's some differences between the two for sure. Okay, so it depends on what you do with it, but is a quality book. So not one I've read recently, but have a read, Coops.
Okay.
And we'll touch base with you again
well,
a little bit down the road.
It's hard to, you know, to go and read it because Dylan recommended it, but the fact that you two guys recommended it, I'll go for it.
It's nice. He did tell us after last week's podcast, ironically enough, his off-season reading is 1-3-1 zone offense after he caught one against the old Casey Youth League men's team. But
hilarious.
That's okay.
Yeah,
that's all right. So as an extension to book club this week, this entire podcast is actually about a book club in general because there was an article written by Jay Billis in 2009 on toughness in general, and that's where we're going with this one. And that article was born into a book, which if you haven't read the book, again, not a bad read overall. We'll unpack a lot of it as we go through this. But toughness is a word that gets thrown around a lot. I've been on so many interview panels over the last 3 to 4 months where every coach will come in and say, I want the toughest team. It's like, yeah, but what does that actually mean? Like, talk me through how you're going to get there. What's it going to look like? So I'm curious to both of you to start off with. We'll start with you on this, Jenna. When you think toughness, like, who comes to mind for you? Like, is there a player that you sort of sit there and say, that's the person I think of when toughness is thrown out there?
Like a Kelsey Griffin comes to mind for me.
Yep.
She's just relentless with everything she does. She doesn't stop moving. She crushes the offensive rebounds relentlessly, runs the floor really well. She definitely comes to mind when I think of toughness.
Well, when you think about how many head contusions she's had over the years as well by putting herself in positions where it's like, oh, you probably shouldn't be in there, but you found a way, but okay, that's maybe another 2 weeks on a concussion. Like, it's like she's just that type of a player, like wears the heart on the sleeve. Like, it's a great example straight off the bat. What about you, Coops?
Yeah, a couple of names. Delly, I think, is probably the obvious one. And then the other one would be Nick Kay.
Yeah, okay.
And Nick Kay in particular, when you think about that toughness aspect to playing the game a certain way, you know, physically, but important, unselfishly, and I'm sure, you know, we'll get to this, but, you know, there's a real aspect of toughness to play unselfishly, to set multiple screens, to always give up, you know, a shot for a better one and to potentially finish a game without having impacted the stat sheet, but impacting the game, there's that's a big area of toughness for me.
And I think that's the big one. It's those things that don't show up on the stat sheet that is that toughness element.
Yep, and not getting credit for stuff is a big part of it. And that's a difficult skill to teach. When you jump on any of the social media platforms at the moment, you can normally find a highlight reel of some kid dropping 35 in a game, and it's like, yeah, but that's not a good shot. Like, you've taken that over four people. Like, you're being fairly closely guarded here and you've still elected to shoot it. Well, okay, those are the things that get clicks, but they're not always the things that would propel a team to a win or a better situation. So it's a tough definition, I suppose, between the two. So I agree with both of you. It's a little unfortunate if you've gone with a non-Victorian in Nick Kay, Coop. Like, Kelsey by now is an honorary Victorian, so that's okay. So there's no issues.
I did start with Delly, right?
No, you did say that. You did, but, you know, try not to deviate too much from that if you don't really have to. I must admit, they were the ones I thought of. I was talking to Zoe this morning, and she said Christy Harrower was another one where you sort of think back, and it's like, yep, that's tough, and it's almost a shame that we don't have as much footage of players of that era and generation. It's like, hey, this is what it looks like. There's just so much out there. So the next million-dollar question, Coops, how do you teach it?
Yeah, well, it's kind of classified into two areas, right, in terms of the physical toughness and then the mental aspect of it. And obviously they need to be nurtured separately, but then also, you know, we'll come together. So obviously this is a pretty kind of rich tapestry of development. But if we're starting with the unselfishness that we spoke about, there's a great way in just creating a culture that rewards unselfishness. And a lot of the times we let unselfish play go kind of, for lack of a better term, unrewarded or unrecognized. And when you think about young players in particular, they love positive reinforcement, and especially they love it from you, the coach, their role model, their hero, the person they love playing for. So when we're talking about just trying to get players to do something that we want them to do, and in this case, playing tough, well, let's start rewarding it. Let's start recognizing it. Let's start giving it the same accolade that we're giving the basket or, you know, the assist or whatever it may be. You know, is there a moment that you can start every film session with three toughness clips? You know, we would do that a bit when I was assisting Justin Schuler with the Crocs, that we would have what we call Crocs ball. And, you know, when there was someone diving on a loose ball or taking a charge, we would always clip that and we would throw that in as part of our film review. So, I mean, I could go on and on, but I think that's a really great place to start is find the things, the tough aspects that you want in your team, in your culture, and just start recognizing them.
Yep. What about you, Jenna? How would you go about teaching it?
I think we just spoke about Malcolm Gladwell's book and the 10,000 hours, and it's about creating those habits that at training you are boxing out every time because that is a toughness thing and you need that as a habit. You run the floor hard every time. You cut hard. Like, all those little things is a habit that you can set at training from the very first moment you get with your team.
Yeah, and it is it's something that you have to be on top of. Like it's, and this is hard because there are so many items on this list to go through, obviously, and we'll try and get through most, but we probably won't get through all. It is one of those things where if you really emphasize 20 things, you're probably not really emphasizing anything. So you got to maybe pick two or three things that really matter to you and your team. And that might be a case of you work with your team to work it out. It's like, well, okay, you tell me what you think is toughness as the playing group. We'll do it as the coaching group. We'll come together somewhere in between and work out what we really want to emphasize. Because, I mean, and you touched on it, Coops, like I was at a session on Saturday. A player threw a pass that led to just a wide open layup, and player caught it, made the layup, and just ran off back down. It's like, hey, how about a little bit of a, hey, good job on that? Oh, why? It's like, do you want that pass thrown to you again? Because it's very easy to look you off next time down the floor. Like, that is a bit of a toughness thing, but you've got to reinforce it.
Yeah.
So straight away, it's like, well, if you don't acknowledge the passer, is that the right thing to be doing? Like, have you played in teams like that, Jenna, where it's been a conscious, hey, we really need to address this part of our culture to get it right?
I don't think I've ever really addressed it before, yeah. But I think there was certain teams that just came together and celebrated that stuff so much more than other groups that's I was with.
Yep, that's a really good point. If you, because there's also an element of if you have to talk about it, is it really there? Mm. Like it's, you know, does it have that underlying current underneath where, like, you look at the All Blacks, like that tapestry and of what the All Blacks culture is, like everyone talks about it all the time. Like it's just the, like the James Kerr book legacy, another book shout out that we'll jump in there, but they talk about what the culture of that is, and it's that whole you don't own the jersey. Like, you occupy it for a little while, but you don't own that thing. Like, you have to leave the place better than when you found it, how it moves on. And it's like, well, that's toughness to uphold, because there will be times where you've beaten black and blue on the court, and the last thing you feel like doing is doing the right thing off the court. But, you know, the hard thing is the right thing. That's how it works.
We had, when I was coaching Sandringham's under 18 boys, where I remember we would do, we would have some scrimmages, and if you scored and within basically the first second, if you didn't wheel around and point to the person that passed you the ball, the score didn't count. And the guys started like really enjoying this just from that fun aspect of, you know, they would get a score and then, you know, they wouldn't do it. And then like a second later, they would do it too late. And I'm like, no, it's too late. And, you know, obviously get all that fun ribbing and so on. That was a really nice way just to start promoting it a little bit. I've heard another one, John Gordon, author, who's done some really good stuff. He's worked with some lacrosse teams in the past. I think they had an actual hard hat.
Yep.
So that was like the person that, you know, exhibited the toughness that they wanted. They got to wear the hard hat for the week or whatever it may be. So there are some fun ways that you can find to really promote it with your team.
We did it with our FTP kids this year. So we're under 14 kids out in Doreen. So we had every week they had to shoot 10 free throws. I think it was 10 free throws during the session. So we break them up into groups of two, shoot them, give us the scores and all that sort of stuff. If they were the champion at the end, they got the WWE belt that they get the picture with.
So good.
We had another chain for like whoever the best defender was. So it was like a chain with a padlock on it. Young kids. Dumb stuff they find hilarious and amusing and those sorts of things. We had another one, I think it was like for best leader, I think it was, which was like the captain's hat. And I think we had like a money chain as well, which was like whoever won the shooting comp for that week. But there are ways that you can sort of get it in there without really having to overemphasize things as well. And they're the little sort of breadcrumbs I think you lead along the way. And it's like, hey, we're actually emphasizing stuff you don't even realize we're emphasizing. Yeah. Because I know with the free throws, like for some reason, the championship belt was the most coveted prize at our training sessions.
Of course. I want a championship belt.
Yeah. I still got it. Like I'll bring it into the office for you. I did mean to put like a little free throw thing on the front and I never got around to it. But for them, that was the big thing. It's like, hey, how many has Coops got? It's like six. It's like, great. Like I've got seven. It's like, yeah, but that kid over there has got eight. And it's like, damn it. Like they'd walk over there and try and put them off when they're shooting free throws to try and win it. But bit of competition was actually a lot of fun. Like I really enjoyed that side of things as well. So when you talk toughness, it's not just I think everyone immediately goes to who is the big brute in the team that just sets ridiculously good screens and bashes people. It's not the case. Like there's so much more to it than that. That is a very small sliver of what toughness actually looks like. And we always want them in our team, but we don't always know how to bring out the best in people to get that as well.
Right. It's a great point. And noticing too that what we haven't spoken about is doing like a box out drill for 45 minutes. And if they don't box out, we run 17 in a minute every time. You know, there is a way to promote this stuff in a fun way that keeps the game enjoyable and keeps using that fun and that, again, positive way to keep the athletes coming back and making basketball the most enjoyable thing that they do in their week.
Yep. So on that, first one is set a good screen. So when you talk about screening in particular, we'll just hit on some teaching points, maybe a player that really reinforces this for you as to who is a good screener that you've seen. One of my favorite tweets of all time was a guy that tweeted at Bogut. He's like, hey, I didn't realize you're in the ice cream business. And Bogut's like, what the heck are you talking about? And he's like, oh, I'm just at your place. It's called Move and Pick. And Bogut's like, got me. Like, it's like I got no response for this, but it is one of those areas where it's like setting a good screen isn't just for you. It is the ultimate act of unselfishness in that you're getting someone else open to potentially get a score that may not lead to you. Who is the best screener you've seen, Coots? What are your teaching points that you like to teach in screening?
The best screener. It's a great question. I mean, I like the European bigs. You know, in the Euro League, just in the way that they hunt screens, they're smart in terms of their read at the screen, you know, flipping, twisting, and then the way that they separate too in understanding how to read the defense, but also play to their strength. Are they a lob threat? Are they a pop threat? So, yeah, I probably couldn't give you a name right now because I think I'm spoilt for choice in my head, but we did some screening, screen setting and screen using as part of our toughness component of our top 30 camp. I think I said it on the pod that, you know, it was the first 2 hours of camp, and that was part of it. And one of the biggest things for me within that teaching is having the screen go and seek the contact. And so many times our young players stop short, and whether that's fear of contact or whether they've been coached to stop short because of worrying about a moving screen.
Sorry, I just have Costanza in my head. Dad Costanza stopping short.
Oh, nowhere near enough Seinfeld references on this pod.
That's right. That's right. Nice. I like
all-time actor too. Like his work in, what was the other show? King of Queens?
Yeah.
Oh, brilliant. Like never realised it was Ben Stiller's dad.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Zoolander.
Yeah, that's
oh yeah, another great one. Yeah.
Sorry, I've sidetracked you there. Couldn't.
I like it.
Let me just reel this thing back from that tangent. And
the fire alarm goes off. We're all going to be fighting to get out the door first. Like it's the same problem.
I remember listening to a podcast and they were talking about the difference between international European bigs, in particular, compared to college bigs. In the US, and that's a big one. The college athletes, the ball comes to the screen, and in Europe, the screen goes to the ball. And I think when you're talking about going and setting good screens, that's a great place to start.
Yep. I remember listening to a similar another podcast where a coach is like, if my five doesn't get two moving picks a game, they haven't done their job. Like I'm happy to give a couple up just on that. Go like really be physical with someone and go find it. In that world. What about you, Jenna? What are the things you look for in good screeners?
Thinking about a person that I used to like playing pick and roll with in particular was Kayla George.
Yeah, right.
She would definitely come seek out that screen, and I think she knew it was because I was quite a good passer.
Yep.
And she was very good at the short roll to the corner in particular.
I'm a chance here.
Like yeah, if you set a good screen, like you know I'm going to get it back to you.
Yep.
And so I think we worked really well out of the pick and roll together. In terms of teaching, it's the three S's.
Yep.
So the sprint to the screen, depending on which age group you're teaching, it's either smash, which is sort of similar to what you're talking about, or smart if we're smashing them a bit hard, and then the separation out of it.
Yep.
And I think something that I've been focusing on lately with my teaching in screens is just the angle of the screen. If you're setting the screen, your back needs to be where the offensive player wants to go.
Yep.
And I think we sometimes are sprinting into it and we're so eager to get there that our angles are all off. So that's been something that I've been focusing on more recently with my teaching as well.
Yep.
Yeah, we talk a lot about winning the basket side battle. I've heard other coaches, I think Andy Lim says hit low, stay low. I think Gorge spoke about hitting low legs. And that angle that Jenna's talking about, especially just to create that advantage, to understand you know, once you get too committed to the ball or you get the roller below those two players, like that's where you're getting your advantage. And obviously we're just talking about pick and roll play at the moment. That's really important for young screeners to understand. There's another quote I have from Francesco Nani, who's, you know, been a friend of our program for a long time, talking about that screener sprinting in like Jenna's talking about. And as soon as they see the footwork of the ball defender change, so as the hips kind of go into a forward pivot to chase the ball, job's done. They're now committed to the ball, to going over the top. You can now get out of there. So there's some things there around the angle, where they want to be, how to create the advantage, how to see the advantage, which ties into great screen setting, but not necessarily hitting someone on the screen, because obviously it's really about the advantage.
Yeah, I like it. All right, so next one, setting up your cut. And this is difficult to do from the perspective that our players do tend to play at one pace only, and there's not enough deception and cat and mouse about how do I get open? Am I setting you up to then go get open? I think I've told the story on the pod before. Sharks Varanay, who was out here for a coaching clinic way, way, way back, spoke about it. It's like, you know, if you're trying to steal something from a shop, you don't just walk in there and steal it. You walk in there, you sort of look around for a little bit. Where are the cameras? Okay, excellent. Can I get someone in my line of sight? Great, now I'm out. Similar sort of concept. And I really like that from the whole read what's going on. Don't just cut because you feel like you have to cut. Read where your defender is. When does their head turn? That's when you have to go. But there's some cutting discipline involved with all of that, because it's not as simple as I feel like I can get open, so now I'll cut. Yeah, but you might impact on someone else's ability to get open down the line. Like there's some cause and effect, I think, that goes with that. So setting up a cut, we won't talk a lot about that because it sort of speaks for itself. But the next one I'm really keen to get into, talk on defense. So, okay, it's on you to start off with, Jenna. When you hear talk on defense, is this something that you just sort of feel like we don't do enough? Like, is it as simple as that? Or is there a way we could be teaching it better to get more of it?
We definitely don't do it enough. Yep. And I'm starting to think sometimes on the girl's side, sometimes they don't know what to say.
Yep.
So it's all well and good for coaches to be like, you need to talk on defense. But I do think we need to break it down a little bit in terms of what we can actually communicate, what positioning we're in and stuff like that. And I don't know, the thing that coaches say a lot is to talk your action. And yes, it's really hard to be on split line. I mean, to say you're on split line if you're not there, it's really hard to say denial if you're not in denial. Yep. So if you're talking your action, you're most likely going to be at least close to that position. If you're not, you could be anywhere. And I just think as a basketball player, if you're not communicating, if you're not talking, you are selfish.
It's a fair point. Like, and even if you're lying on it though, like how many times do you hear someone say, I'm on split? And it's like, no, you're not. You're on the lane line. Like you are selling your play down the river here because they think you've got their back on split line and you're miles away from where that needs to be. So there, like I like the whole talk your action, but there are times where you can over talk too, where it almost becomes noise and it's not really an instruction being given from a player, because there's a line between the two. Like I would probably rather go over than under, because I think we're very much in the under at the moment. I don't think we talk enough, but there is a line in there too where, like, we talk about stay-go calls. Like, you better be loud. And, you know, I think you might have talked about that ELO, like early loud, often coops. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how we want our players to talk on defense. Don't be the kid that sits there and says, ball, 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 ball. Like, you're just going to give someone a migraine. Like, that's just annoying. But that ball declaration straight away, I got ball. You should hear voices behind you of, hey, I got help off shoulder. I got, you know, denial here, whatever the case might be. That's actually intimidating for the other team. It's like, holy cow, when the ball moves, like we're just getting punched in the face with noise almost.
It's a different level of pressure that the offense feels with that.
Yeah. Like they're dialed in as a group. It's like, yeah, how are we going to score now? Like we got to rely on turnovers. Like how do you get talk on it, Coops? Like is there anything you've done in the past?
We're just building on that. There's that great story about Rajon Rondo and his basketball IQ and understanding the opposition, and the opposition would come down and call out their play and he would repeat it, you know, oh, horn 77. Guys, they're horn 77. They're going to go here, here, then they're going to run this, right? Remember how we're defending it? And the other team be like, oh my God,
yeah.
they know what we're doing. Yeah. We're stuffed, you know. I think what you're both saying about the what is huge. Like, it's got to start there. I think just drilling down on it further is, do the athletes understand your terminology? Do you have set terminology so they know what they are supposed to be saying? Something we stole from Andre Lemanis, I've got, you've got. So again, that's just something punchy to talk about. Okay, I've got nail, you've got ball. I've got split, you've got help right. Another one too, to extend that a little bit further, is using someone's name. And obviously that goes into all sorts of, you know, relationship and communication strategy. But when you hear your name, you know, it makes
you're locked
you,
in.
It makes you listen. You know, people like hearing their name. So when you're talking about Rob, you know, Rob, you've got nail. You know, Jenna, I've got split. And then all of a sudden it's like, oh, okay. I'm actually being spoken to right now. I'm actually receiving genuine communication around, you know, who we are, where we're at, and what we're trying to do.
Because that's the next part of communication, right, is listening.
Yep, 100%. Yep.
And sometimes I feel like there is talk, but we're not listening to what is going on. So being able to say their name, that locks them in, and then that's part of the second part of communication of listening.
There are very few quiet environments in basketball. Like whether it be a domestic game on a Saturday where there is 100 kids around one court and all those types of things, or whether you be in the big gyms where there's music playing, they're never quiet environments. So I think every Saturday my watch goes off with, you've been in a loud environment for too long here. It's like, okay, I'll move away from the speaker or whatever the case might be. But it's always loud. So you have to be on the I'll say lookout, knowing that it's a visual thing, but it is, you've got to be listening for what's going on around you to know when and where. Because like if you're, say, icing an on-ball screen and you don't know when your footwork has to adjust on that on-ball screen to send it down, and someone's saying ice, 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 and you haven't gone there yet, well, you've kind of shafted your whole team.
Mm.
Like, so you've got to be listening for your teammates in that space too.
Yeah, it's part of that selfish behavior, you know, that if you're not listening, that's what you're doing. Yeah, I totally agree in terms of that loud environment. We talk a lot to our athletes at camp around being authentic, you know, so be you, be the person that you're developing into, and really cherish that. And if that's a quiet person off the floor, if you're an introvert, if you're quiet, great. Be you, be that authentic version of yourself. But when you cross the white line, you have to find another personality. You have to find your competitor that's in you, and that competitor is a talker. Because we say it all the time, and Jenna knows better than anybody in terms of the level that, you know, that she's played at. If you can't talk, you can't play. Like, it's just going to stop you from going on and achieving the things that you want to achieve.
Yeah, without a doubt. And that kind of leads a little bit into the next one, which is don't get screened. It's a lot easier to not get screened if someone's talked and you've heard it. The last thing you want to do is have your head rattled in the backcourt by a terror screen that nobody told you was coming, and you pick yourself up the floor and you're looking around for what was that, and who is responsible for not telling me that pick was coming. But that is a big part of it. Don't get screened. Like, talk that early so that it doesn't have to happen in the first place. But the next one I want to hit on.
Sorry, Rob, just quickly. One of the things that Bestie says I love is your ears are your eyes. You know, when you're in that moment, especially defending the ball and here comes a screen from behind or underneath, your ears are your eyes. I think that's another great one for our coaches to utilize.
Yeah, I like that a lot. Jumping to the ball on defense. This is one of my pet peeves. Like, let nothing over your chest. And that is, again, do the work early. Like, jump towards where the ball gets passed. Make sure it always goes behind you. Trust that split help will be there to help you out along the way. But don't let stuff across your chest. And it goes back a little bit to what we were talking about before with, you know, how we set up and what do we really emphasize in certain things. I see it so often in, say, a shell drill. They'll be going through, pass from top to wing, cut through so that we can play the on ball and we'll get our rules sorted for our on ball. And the emphasis is never on don't let the cut go across your chest. And it's like, no, your drill's broken, one pass in. Like, you've got to fix that before you can even talk as to what it is. Are there any teaching points that you use, Jenna, to just make sure that players are aware of what's coming and how to do the work early in that space?
Well, it seems pretty... seems basic to me.
Yeah.
You jump to the ball. It's self-explanatory. And I think I don't, when I'm first teaching, yes, I'll stop it and bring it back. But if we have gone on to, as you've said, if it's passed to the wing, cut into the on-ball screen, I'll say if we can score, we're absolutely scoring.
Yeah,
if you don't jump to the ball at the end of that possession, you've got three push-ups.
Yep.
And like it's, why am I giving you 3 push-ups? I didn't jump to the ball. Well, yeah, you need to do that every time. And it's in the first bit of shell, it generally is done quite well. But when we build on it, it all just goes out the window.
Yes. Yeah. 3 or 4 passes in or a couple of reps down the line. It's like, yeah, I've been jumping to the ball. I can't be bothered on this one. And all of a sudden someone's off your shoulder and done. That's the killer.
And then it's really important to highlight the low, the help, the captain, whoever it is, that if it's a layup over the top, that's not your fault.
Yep.
That's the rest of our defense, so that we're all on the same page together.
Yep. Yeah, that for me, there's 2 key parts in there. One is, I mean, how many skip passes are we seeing thrown nowadays?
Rare,
right? Yeah, very rare. Yeah. Like, it's really not happening. And to the point where not only are we not throwing them, but I would say a lot of athletes aren't capable of throwing it. So if that's not an available counter, and we know that every coach wants their player to drive and get paint pressure or must get a paint touch before a 3, all those sorts of things, then the jumping to the ball is vital. Yep. You know what I mean? It must happen. So, I think the other part too is, you know, building on what Jenna was saying at the end there, is that especially with the extended movement and maybe we're after a scramble or in a scramble, that mindset of controlled environment, I can show the coach that I'm jumping to the ball and I'm putting possession first. But then when it gets real, it's like, where's my man? Or is my man going to score? Oh, I can't let my man score. Yep. If my man scores, then I get subbed off. I don't get to play anymore. And so that comes back to the culture that you're building. Yep. You know what I mean? In that daily environment. And we try and talk about that a lot here. But that's a joint venture, because that's a really hard thing to break down in athletes.
And I've seen kids in the past where they almost have a little bit of a deal with the player they're playing on. It's like, hey, you don't face cut me and I won't face cut you. And it's like, no. Like, you're shortchanging your teammates now. Like, make them better. Like, get them on something. Like, really set them up and just nail them on a cut.
Be tough.
Yeah, that's the toughness side of things. Like, it's like, there's the tagline straight away. But it is. It's one of those things. Like, stop trying to shortcut the drill. Like, I'm all for hacking a drill and cheating and all that sort of stuff. I've got no problem with that. But don't shortchange people. Like, make them better.
Yeah.
Like, force them to defend. I think that's part of it.
It's such a great point, Rob. And I remember saying to a couple of groups of athletes recently around, you know, you should never let anybody stand in the way of your career. And basketball is a team sport. And if we're on a team together and you're not giving me your best and you're not pushing me or you're not doing what, you know, potentially the coach is saying for us to have the success, like, you're getting in the way of me being able to go on and do the things that I want to do in the sport. So you've got to be able to hold people accountable to doing the things that you're talking about.
Yep, really like it. This is one that we always, I think, link in with toughness. Get on the floor. Like, don't ever be beaten to a loose ball in that sort of space. And look, there are times where it's a bit kamikaze-ish. And we spoke about Dele before. Like, Dele was nearly run hated by half the NBA. Oh, he's taking our legs out. And it's like, well, get on the floor. Like, this won't be a problem then. Stop bending down to pick up the ball and just secure that thing. Like, he carved himself out a career by just being the toughest guy that would get on the floor first. And the extension to that, I think, is if someone is prepared to get on the floor for your team and there's a stoppage, go get them up. That's such a big part of it. Like, when you look at, like, the culture of teams, and it's like, that guy or girl has just busted their backside for you and you're pretty content, hey, good job, and just point at them down the other end of the floor. No, run your ass over there and go and get them back up again. Like, is that something you emphasize in sessions, Jenna? Like, is that, like, just building that little bit of camaraderie and cohesion of, hey, they've done the right thing, go get them?
Absolutely. We're all getting better together.
Yep.
And as you said, you elevate each other by pressuring and hard work. And yeah, if someone's diving on the ball, you must go pick them up.
Yeah. And it's amazing how many times I've seen the opposition player go to pick them up and they slap the hand away. It's like, no, my teammate will come and get me on this one. It's like, geez, I hope they do. Like, otherwise, this looks really bad. But it is one of the things. Like, when we look at toughness, like, those that are prepared to go and secure the ball, sacrifice the body to get the possession, who knows what that possession will mean in the grand scheme of the game? Like, it's, you know, you might win or lose by 30 points, in which case it probably doesn't mean a whole lot. But you never know when that possession matters in those tight games in particular. And I think we've all been in games where down the stretch we sat there and it's like, oh, if we only had 2 more possessions, we would have been a chance. Well, that might be your possession.
Story time, Rob.
Hey, here we go.
In my second year of college, I was starting to struggle, like starting to couldn't really find my place on the team and wasn't really getting shots. And I was like, man, from where I've come from in Australia, like this thing's starting to kind of come off the rails. And I thought, oh, what can I do? And I thought, all right, I'm just going to try and be the best teammate. I'm over here, you know, I'm on scholarship, all those sorts of things. I'm just going to try and enjoy this experience. And I really love my teammates. So I'm like, I'm just going to try and be the best teammate I can be the loudest guy on the bench, dive on loose balls, set screens, draw charges, and ended up carving out a season being able to do that. And I think I was only one of two players that played in every game and then ended up winning the most inspirational award at our season awards. Now, I'm not saying that.
A bronze statue of you at the front of that college at the moment with just like flexing as like the most inspirational player?
Yeah, one at the front, one at the back, one up at the admin hall, but who's counting? And obviously I don't say that to big note. I'm just saying that, you know, there's a world in which these things can contribute to having, you know, success, having joy, and potentially having a career at the levels that we know a lot of our athletes want to play at.
And it's sort of what we said at the start. It's all those things that aren't on the box score. There's only one basketball. There's only one person that can score at a time. So what are the other four players doing on the court at that time?
Yes.
They're setting good screens. They're diving on loose balls. They're getting rebounds. They're running hard.
Yep.
And to a coach, that is so valuable. Maybe the people sitting in the stands are noticing the person who scores 30 points, but it's the person who does all that stuff that is the glue to the team that has success.
Yeah. Yep. A little bit of foreshadowing here. Our next two podcast episodes is going to be one, how to run a selection trial, because we're obviously coming up into trials. But also it's going to be a player's podcast on what to do at trials. So if you are a player, what are you going into and some advice. The easiest way for mine to get noticed is to be the greatest talker and the person that is just like a bulldog and just goes and finds the ball. Now, can you have a team full of 10 of them? Probably not, because there's some other intangibles you will need across the course. But straight away, like if you walk into a trial and you see a kid get on the floor straight away, it's like, hey, that's a pretty good example straight away of I'm going to remember that kid. Or I'm going to look out for that kid when we get the scrimmages. And it's just such an easy way of putting you front of mind for coaches. There is not a coach out there that doesn't want more possessions. And if you're that person that can create more possessions for your team, how are you not valuable? Like it's just such an easy one, I think, for mine.
I love it. We had a kid at our phase one trials. He's an under 18. I'll say this. He was extremely undersized. Yep. But immediately noticed through his communication, his basketball IQ, his ability to bring people together, like he was such a wonderful influence on the floor. And when we got to the, you know, the selection meetings, every time his name came up, because it was like, God, this guy, you know, the way he's communicating, the way he's understanding what we're trying to do. And unfortunately there was a bunch of different reasons to why we couldn't select him, but we were still
building to a climax there.
I need to remind the community that if you're short, you do not have a place in basketball. I'm just kidding. It was more about the fact that he got noticed. He got noticed, and we were still talking about him at the end of the day around, can we get this guy in coaching? You know, can we find other ways to keep this kid involved in the sport because of the things that he was able to do?
So it could be a good news story at the end of it.
Could be.
I hope so.
Could be.
Jeez. That was like an M. Night Shyamalan twist that I did not see coming. Like, that kid has now gone to represent Australia at multiple Olympics. No, nothing like that. That's all right. Post your player, not a spot. This is an argument I have with players continually. They're like, oh, I'm playing in the post. It's like, yeah, but your player's not there. So go and post them up. Like, go and find contact first rather than allowing contact to come to you. And it ties back into the screening stuff, obviously. But so many times I see players like in transition, which ties into our next point, which is run the floor. But they will be the first big down the floor and they'll run to the post. And it's like, no, don't run to the low block. That doesn't help anyone there. Like, pin and seal on the rim, make them guard you the whole time. They can check out and guard too if you just run to the low block. That's an easy one. But that whole post your player, not a position, not a spot, I think for mine is really valuable. Look, what Coops, we'll call you our pseudo post player here. Like, it's what would your teaching points be for players to go and find contact, especially in transition when they're running the floor, to go and post?
Yeah, I mean, you look at every clip of you know, a post feed being poked away from that defender behind, and it's a result of what you're talking about, right? So, yeah, we talk a lot about, you know, stop, steal, you know, look for the body. We talk a lot about splitting the stance of that defender, so attacking the chest but splitting their feet with your, what we call our inside leg, and then using that to create the reverse pivot to sit and hold. You know, the old adage, thumbs in the ears or something, where we're, you know, knocking that arm away that's trying to reach over the top and impact. So, yeah, it's there's a bunch of techniques and strategies that we can use, but I think before that is creating an environment that's really comfortable with physicality and comfortable with contact. And so, you know, you saw Adam Ford do those ignition drills, you know, learning from the Cowboys and taking that to his Cairns guys. And, you know, there's a version of that that, you know, we could all be doing on a regular basis. Obviously, it starts with safety first and making sure that we're doing it the right way and no one's going to get injured or get hurt. But, like, players just need to get comfortable with hitting each other. Like, that's the brand of basketball that they want to play in terms of going on to play for their country or play professionally. So, yeah, I've got to get comfortable with it.
Jenny, you're a bit of a tweener in terms of you could play as a guard or as a post when needed. How did you work out when was the time? Like, when did you sort of work out, hey, I think I've got the mismatch here, I can go to the post versus having to play on the perimeter?
Yeah, just reading the defense.
Yeah.
In pick and rolls in particular.
Yep.
They would generally switch because yep. I was a pick and pop type player, but if yep. a small person was on me, I was rolling that little mouse down and posting her up and, yep. you know, then knowing what's coming next, there's going to be a trap that's coming. So knowing where my other offensive players are so I can yep. get that quick catch and out again, just absolutely reading the defense and reading what's going to be happening next.
Some would call that scanning, Coops.
Mm.
Yeah, there you go. No. It's a great point because, in all honesty, a lot of the times I see when teams run offense, they'll see a mismatch, they'll stop running their entire offense to try and go at that mismatch in particular. It's like, no, just keep running your offense. The ball will get there eventually as to when it needs to get there. But the awareness to know, well, okay, when it does invariably come in, what do I have to do next? Because the ball is going to be coming out of my hands again quickly. Very rarely do you get to go like two dribbles back down score. Like it tends to be catch high, finish high, and you know, maybe the occasional bounce pass in there. But, you know, depending on what's going on, it tends to be that.
Yeah, or if you're the ball handler yeah. and you know there's a switch and there's a mismatch, it's the fake, the pass, so you know that the trap is coming and then skipping yeah. it to the weak side corner for yeah. that yep. three-point shot. Yeah. So it's, yeah, all about scanning and reading the defense and where it's going.
Yep. When did you develop that awareness, that what's next mindset? Is there something you can kind of trace back to? Was there an age? Is there something that you can potentially pass on?
So something that I have a terrible memory, terrible. But
I said that before.
Yeah,
no, I'm joking. I'm messing with
you. that was good by you, thanks. But I remember Phil Brown at the AIS when I was there. He was very big on making the pass that makes the assist. So that got me really thinking about that next play, next action mentality, because yeah, the post is open, but you don't have the angle. It's making the pass to the wing that's then going into the post. And he was big on that for the year and a half I was at the AIS. And that's always stuck in my mind.
Yeah. Great cool. one.
I like yeah. that. Play so hard, your coach has to take you out. How do you get through to players, Jenna? That's, it's not a case of, hey, just save yourself for the fourth quarter. It is a case of play so hard that you need to get a break. Like, how do we get that through to players?
Look, I know coaches who did this with me, yep. and it was, if you call for a sub, have a quick blow, I will get you back in. But if you just coast, and I'm seeing you not trying hard out there, you're going to be on the bench and not come back in because you're not giving effort. So it's getting through to them that, yeah, you need to go hard. And if you can train yourself to go harder, those minutes get extended too. But I feel like so often there's young boys and girls who are required maybe to play a full 40 minutes on a Friday night that they pace themselves for the whole game, don't try too hard on defense because they're required to score 30 points on the offensive end. But I think we're just setting up for really bad habits moving forward. And then they come into a session with me where I'm like, get out and run, and they just don't have that in them. So it's coaches being like, go hard for these 2-3 minutes, get a quick 30-second minute blow, I'll put you back in. And then those minutes will slowly increase as you get fitter and you get used to playing at that level.
Yep. Bump.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly right though. Like we see it all the time, and it was one of my pet peeves at FTP this season. It's like, hey, we're 20 minutes into the session and your hoodie's still on. Why? And it was never because, oh, we're not doing a competitive drill. Every drill we did was competitive this year, like deliberately done that way because we had to sort of try and teach some habits of, hey, don't coast. Like you've got to make everything competitive. If your hoodie's still on after 20 minutes of practice, you haven't been training hard enough. It's not the content's fault. The content is designed to make you sweat. And every other kid looking around has their hoodie off. Why don't you? It's like, yeah. And amazingly, the hoodie would come off straight away. And it's like, you know, you've missed the point here. Like, it's maybe work hard to get the hoodie off. But it is that sort of thing. Like, our kids are conditioned, I think, to pace. And that is, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, you know. Like, they just have that self-preservation thing. But I also do wonder, and it probably leans into a little bit of a safety thing here, which you touched on earlier too, Coops. How many of our players could play 40 minutes if they really had to at game-like intensity? Like, and they just don't exist. So you will need a break at some point, and that's okay. Coaches aren't going to look at you like, hey, I can't believe it. I think once in all my years of coaching has a kid come to me and said, I need a sub, and I've said no once.
Did you call a timeout instead?
I did.
Yeah.
And that's
there's
exactly
ways around it.
Yeah. Like I could manipulate it a little bit, and that was the only reason. It's like, hey, I cannot afford to take you off. You have 38 of our 42 points at the moment. We kind of need you out there. This will be a timeout rather than a sub. And I think it was just before a three-quarter time. So I think I maybe got him making an extra possession in there where it's like, look, I'll get you a minute, then I'll get you a sub for the last 20-odd seconds, then you get three-quarter time, but then I need you again, and you're good to go. But that fitness base to be able to play at that level, and this ties a little bit into like Darren McInnes talks about it, like if you're in the off-season, don't send your players on a 10K run. It's not the same level of fitness that is required for players to be able to play the game fit stuff that he has on the app. Brilliant.
Even if you want to get off your feet as well, the 8 seconds on, 12 seconds off on the bike is some heavy duty.
Yep.
Won't more game. He had me doing that a lot.
I think part of the problem too is when we're playing so many games per week down here in Victoria in particular, the athletes don't have time to work on conditioning, or they're just trying to get through potentially one practice because they've got another practice that same night, or they're practicing in the afternoon and they've got a game that night. And so I think we need to continue to look at some structural change to help support the athletes in this area.
And that is largely conditioning.
Yeah.
Like they have to be fitter, but they just have to be fitter to be able to play that. And that requires a lot of moving parts to work together, like for the benefit of the athlete, not because, hey, I need you, so you have to be healthy for this and can the rest of it. It is, okay, what is good for the player here? And that might be, hey, you need a rest day, or that might be jump on the bike instead of doing this session, or can you go get a pool session or a yoga session or a Pilates, something different, just to not only refresh the mind, but also to refresh the body a little bit too, because it is taxing for sure. Take and give criticism the right way. Coops, you're all about player empowerment and peer-to-peer coaching in particular.
Yep.
Talk to us about what that looks like.
Yeah, so taking feedback can start with compassion, or can start with empathy in the fact that, you know, thinking about, or even when we're giving the feedback. So what's another way of saying that? Put yourself in the other person's shoes. So when we're thinking about giving or receiving feedback, how is this person dealing with this in terms of how are they delivering it, or how are they going to receive it? So we want to have that in mind. We talk a lot about it's performance, not personal. So we really want to build that in, and that whenever someone's talking to about basketball stuff, it's only performance. It has nothing to do with your character or you as a person. You're purely being held to the high standard that we create in our programs. The other part too is having, again, some common language or some common understanding of how we want to deliver that. And I have a PowerPoint that I'll do some of this stuff with my teams around talking about the accountability and the feedback piece. And Yeah, we don't want to use provocative language or emotive language because that's just going to potentially create angst in the relationship. So if we're keeping it really basic, if we're keeping it to the basketball, basically, that's going to help us off.
Yep.
I agree with that. Sometimes in high-pressure situations, it might be more vocal or more, there might be more emotions around that correct messaging. Yep. So I think it's important to listen to the message and not the tone in some aspects as well. I'm not saying that all the time because you shouldn't be getting yelled at all the time. But in some situations, I think it's really important as an athlete to be able to take the message rather than focusing on the tone in which it's delivered at times.
Yep. You don't always have time to make it sound nice. That's the problem. Like if you have to tell a player something across a court with everything going on, noise and that sort of stuff, sometimes it's going to come across far more angry than it's meant to be. And, you know, we as coaches do need to be conscious of that for sure. Like we may need to sort of soothe some things over afterwards. Like, hey, I'm not angry at you. I'm just trying to get the message to you. But we do have to be conscious of that, I think, as coaches.
Yeah, it might be something little like I've jumped to the ball. It's gone over my head. Noah's on split line. Coops, why weren't you on split line?
Yeah.
Like listen to the message rather than the tone because it is going to be loud in there and I need you to hear that because I need you on split line next time.
Words that were never spoken though, Coops. Words that were never spoken.
Never.
Yep. Continually on never. Split.
I don't really think I left the split line because that would require a lot of work. So I just planted down there.
Doesn't seem easy, does it?
Switch.
Yeah. You got that.
Yeah.
Hey, body language, Jenna. What is good body language to you as a coach looking at players?
Their eyes are on me. They're not fidgeting and taking their shoes off or tying up their shoelace. They've
yeah, that's a pet peeve.
So their eyes are definitely towards me. I love looking down the bench and seeing athletes leant forward rather than back. When something happens, they're cheering. They're not just sitting there with their arms crossed or whatever. On the court, it's definitely getting around each other and giving high fives or a pat on the back. Body language, positive body language is so important because it adds to that culture of a team and how people are getting around each other. And if you have poor body language, I can guarantee it's going to get worse for you and you're going to be stuck on the end of that bench because if a coach looks down and sees you with your back up against the chair, not engaged in the game with what's going on, they're not going to call your name.
Yeah, you're staying there.
Yeah.
It's where you, Coops?
Yeah, exactly the same. Yep. Yeah, I think probably just to double click down is that the something that it took me a long time in my coaching to get to this point was to start asking more questions as to why they potentially were having that body language. And obviously you need to find the right time. Like in the middle of the game is usually not the best time, but if someone was struggling on the court or, you know, leaning back on the bench or whatever it may be that we've identified, just going up and the first question being, hey, is everything okay? Hey, that's not like you. You know, your body language today was off. You know, is everything all right? Have you, started saying, you know, how was your day today? Did you have a rough day today, good day today? So that's the only thing that I think I could add onto that. Yeah.
And as coaches, we have to be conscious of our body language too. There are times, and I know I'm certainly guilty of this, where I can look outwardly angry when that's just not the case. When I coach a lot of the times with my arms folded and I tend to be a walker as I go. So that immediately gives off he's upset about something. It's like, no, not necessarily, just my back's sore and I'm kind of trying to stretch at the same time as I'm doing this. The under 18 girls I used to coach, they're like, hey, we hate it when you stand up and coach. Like, we don't like it. We sort of feel a bit intimidated by it. Can you sit down? And it's like, oh, give it a crack, like in 2.5 minutes. It's like, nope, not for me. Sorry, I've got to walk, but I'll be more conscious of my body language and my tone of voice just to make sure that you don't have that impression of me as the coach in there as well.
You must have had a really good relationship with them for them to be able to say that to you.
Fractured at times, but there were a couple in there that I'd certainly trusted with, hey, you're coming at this from a good perspective, not a, hey, just stop yelling at us perspective. Yep. So it is a bit of a two-way street, I think, with that one as well. A lot of these we've actually covered off as part of the other ones. Go to the class every time. It's not your shot, it's our shot. Absolutely. Look your coaches and teammates in the eye, similar to what you were just talking about with the body language, Jenna. It's a really big one. We'll get to the last two because I'm conscious we're running out of time. Move on to the next play. I think that is probably the hardest one to get right for a lot of our players because they stay in their own heads about things that have gone wrong rather than just saying, hey, nah, done. I'm not getting that one back. What's next? That what's next mentality is so hard to get through. How have you found going from a playing career into a coaching career, Jenna, where you've got kids that overthink a lot of things and you're trying to give them confidence but also teach at the same time.
I think it goes back to what you said at the very beginning. There's physical toughness and mental toughness, and being able to move on to the next play quickly is mental toughness. Yep. Being able to leave that behind, and it's difficult for some athletes because they do overthink everything. But if you're not moving on to the next play, you're going to have compound errors, and you can't have that. Yep. So if you miss an easy layup, it's going to happen, but you then can't let your player score down the other end because you haven't run back on defense. That's a compounding error in my eyes. So I think that comes with that mental toughness. And again, that is done at training where it's, yeah, we're on to the next play constantly, and mistakes are going to happen. You need to have an environment where that is okay, that they are comfortable to move on to the next play as well.
Yeah, I really like that.
Yeah, from a coaching standpoint, I think you've got to be working on this away from the court. Like, it's really hard to have a what's next mentality, you know, whilst you're coaching, and then not have it in your daily life or your professional life or whatever it may be. So I think if you're working on, you know, potentially developing a philosophy.
Ooh, there we go.
Like,
wow.
Stoicism.
You knew Marcus Aurelius.
Is a great way to help. But it's practicing those strategies there. Like, one thing that's helped me on the sidelines is having my assistants be ready to note things down so that I can, you know, if that's something that's happened and I'm a bit, you know, potentially furious at what's happened.
You know.
Now I know really out of character. You know, wheel around, get a quick note on it. So now I know it's noted and we can address it, you know, in post or whatever it may be. And then I can move on to the next play. And then the other part too is role modeling. You know, it's all well and good to be yelling at your athletes what's next while you're busy, you know, screaming at the referee for a bad call. So, yeah, that role modeling part is huge as well.
Yep. And the last one I had, be hard to play against but easy to play with. We all have those players that sit there and it's like, yeah, I really don't like that kid. Then all of a sudden you coach them in a camp or something. It's like, I bloody love that kid. They're fantastic. I just don't like to play against them. But you always want one of them on your team as well. There's a couple that are just out there where it's like, I don't know that I particularly like Chris Goulding, but I'd always pick him. Like, it's one of those sorts of things. Like, you come across as a real pest on court that you'd be a little bit of hard work. I don't think it's the case. Like, I think he's actually a great player that is fantastic. And I see his off the court stuff, and it's like, you come across as the greatest person in the world when you're in media. But he's one of those people that is hard to play against because he's a talker. He lets you know when he's done something really well, but he also performs. And that's the fun stuff. But I feel like he would be easy to play with because he always goes into bat for his teammates. So, do you want to play against him? No, but would you always pick him? Probably. Like, there are those types of players that are over the course that, how do you not let your biases get in the way of that, Jenna? Like, how do you, like, are there people that you sort of look at and it's like, oh, I don't know that I could play with you, but then you play with them and it's like, actually, that worked out really well. Like, they're a little better than I thought they were. I now have a bit more respect for what they bring that I wasn't seeing before.
Oh, that's a really great question. I don't think I've ever thought about that before.
Yep.
I think whatever teammates you play with, I'm going to try and get the best out of them while I try and get the best out of myself as well.
Yep.
I think I've played with some players that people have probably thought are challenging, and I rise to that challenge to get them to buy into what we're doing and really try and enjoy that process of getting to know them as a person.
Yeah.
And as long as, you know, we go into battle together, I can play with anyone.
Yep. It's a great attitude to take towards it. Like, and it sort of ties back into the outlier stuff as well that we were talking about earlier on. Full link in the show. How good is that? But it is. It's, you know, what makes that person great? Like, there are some things that you'd be able to take away from everyone, I feel like, as a teammate or a kid that you coach or whatever the case may be. Everyone brings something. Now, is it something you need? Maybe not always, but there is always something you can take from. And I think there's some enjoyment to be had in that. And it's like, oh, actually, you've changed my opinion on you. As a player or as a coach, there have been some coaches I've coached with where it's like, oh, I don't know, this is going to work. Then you coach them. It's like, nope, that worked really well. Like, it's sometimes you need the foil to whatever you are, and sometimes it just links up. There's just some continuity with it. So it's not easy to get, but, you know, that's the tough thing. Like, you will have to adjust your personality to A, be coached, but B, play with other people. And that's not always easy to do. So that's all we've got. There are a number of those we missed. I'll put these in the show notes as well, just so that everyone can have a little bit of a look if you want to go back in the article. Do recommend the book by Jay Billis on toughness. Duke guy, not my favourite, but, you know, that's okay. But if anyone has got any sort of feedback on their notes or anything like that they want to throw in the comments, they're more than welcome to do that. Of course, over the break, Like I said, our next couple of podcasts coming up are how to run a selection trial, which is obviously going to be valuable for a lot of our VJBL coaches coming in, but also a players podcast where we're going to talk to the players specifically about how they can put their best foot forward at trials to give themselves a chance. And, you know, there are some things that are in your control. There are some things that are out of your control. Hopefully we give you some advice that can at least help along the way as we go through it. Other than that, Jenna, Coops, thank you very much for jumping in today. Coaches, we'll catch you again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Talking Split Podcast. Make sure you like and comment on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget to share and subscribe so that you never miss an episode.